This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Get back to where you once belonged. Get your hands dirty with this week's Grow Up on Radio EcoShock.
We'll hear from the Young Farmers Movement with filmmaker and dirt farmer Severn Von Scharner Fleming of Greenhorn Radio. Community-supported agriculture, organic, getting out, or grow where you are.
Feed the city from the city.
Our second guest, Sharon Astick, says we need a nation of farmers as the oil and fertilizer get scarce, as climate disrupts the rivers and the crops. We may all need to know how to feed yourself from the ground up. Places to start, ways to get going. Radio EcoShock digs in.
Well, the hardest work that ever I done was plowing a field of rye. The easiest work that ever I done was eating chicken pie. Chicken crow for midnight and a chicken crow for day. Long coming, all Lord have mercy, stole my chicken away. Throw back chicken and crow for day. Throw back chicken and fly away. Throw back chicken and I like chicken pie.
What's for dinner? Are you going to have twisted animals from corporate mega barns, maybe? Or pesticide-laced vegetables picked by underpaid field slaves? And I want to ask, who is going to grow your food once the old generation of farmers die off and maybe the barns collapse?
Well, according to the census data, the last census, there were only 3% of farmers under the age of 35. And this most recent census that just came in, it said 6% of farmers under the age of 35. Of course, less than 2% of the American population are farming.
Thankfully, there is a green revolution starting out on the land near where you live. Let's dig in with the new greenhorns. I learned about our next guest from an excellent article posted at grist.org by Eric Hoffner, coordinator of the Orion Grassroots Network. He's a frequent contributor to Orion Magazine. I'm going to steal shamelessly from Eric's knowledge and homework as we chat with Severn Von Scharner Fleming. She's a young farmer and filmmaker at the center of a new movement to grow, well, more young farmers. Severn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've got a new film, a radio show, and an organization all called Greenhorns. Why the name, and what does it mean to you?
Well, greenhorns are, what it really means is a new entrant or an inexperienced practitioner. So many of us who are new to farming and excited about it, we're kind of like the greenhorns on the old Wild West. But we're excited, and so we're tooting our own horns a little bit to show how proud we are of what we're doing.
How did you start your connection to the land? Are you from a farming family?
I was raised in the city. Both of my parents are urban planners, so studying cities and living in cities. But we spent every summer on a farm in my family. And then as soon as I got to college, I, with a friend of mine, was part of a really fabulous college farm project. And we started up that farm and planted what ended up being hundreds of fruit trees and building beds and composting the food scraps from the college, and pretty soon found ourselves organizing harvest festivals and music festivals and just doing a lot of organizing to keep that farm going. And so pretty much ever since then, I've been farming every summer and organizing a lot of educational, celebrational type events pretty much for the last 10 years now.
And that was in Pomona, California, I guess.
That was at Pomona College in Claremont, California.
Right, okay.
A great place to grow guavas.
Well, this is really important. I want to tune into this for a second because around here at the University of Victoria in Canada, hundreds of students just took out a campus lawn in front of the library and they planted food and edible landscaping. And then, of course, the university blindly bulldozed those beautiful raised beds. But the students vow they're going to return and replant. It's kind of a guerrilla farming, and in my opinion, it's way overdue. Why do you think schools can be so hostile to food knowledge, and are there hopeful signs of a turnaround?
I think there are hopeful signs of a turnaround, and you see that with some of the primo liberal arts and elite Ivy League type colleges really competing to be the place for sustainable food, Yale and Williams College, and those types of places are really starting to pay attention to local food for their dining halls and to the interests of their students, many, many, many of whom are really interested in food systems work, both in farming and in the kind of more wonky sides and policy sides of this major challenge that we face. I don't quite understand why the schools are so threatened by young people building an institution around something that they cherish and creating a green space for others to enjoy. I wish that they would change their tune and support the young people who are engaging in that way. And, you know, because it really is a lot of work to build a garden and build a farm from scratch. It's not every college student who works up the enthusiasm to get anything off the ground, let alone a farm. So I would encourage those students to just keep at it. We at Pomona College had quite a long fight, and there were some bulldozers involved at one point, and they wanted to put a soccer field down, and you just have to rally the community, but that's a good skill. That's a good skill to have, to learn how to rally your community and cherish the relationships that make possible a new institution. So I think it's always a good lesson for the students, and hopefully one day the universities will understand. And then at Pomona College, they ended up putting the farm on the admissions tour because they were so proud of it at the end. So I'd say keep your chin up.
That's beautiful. Well, most of the population doesn't know how to grow food, and a lot of people don't even have a clue where food comes from. How can we reintroduce institutions which reward and honor agriculture?
Well, I think just speaking from the perspective of someone who's really deep in the community of young farmers and every day around people and communicating with people who are making their lives in farming, I would say that it starts with the individual, and it starts with the individual's commitment, and that we young people have incredible opportunities right now to go and learn in our summer holidays if we're young, or if we're out of school, to go and sign up for a year or 2 years of service and apprenticeship with someone who already knows what they're doing, and to get trained up. I think that the institutions do exist thanks to some of our elders who made the organic farming movement what it is today, and who started these wonderful sustainable agriculture conferences and bodies all around this country. I think we can just tap into those networks and start with ourselves and not worry too much about very much else. I think we just have to learn what there is to learn and attack where there's a vulnerable spot in the system. And I think that these students who pounce on lawns and guerrilla style it are acting out of, it's a good sense what they're doing.
Can you tell us about your own experiments with farming in the last couple of seasons?
Totally. So I went to the Pomona College and we started that farm. And then I went around, I got a round the world ticket and I woofed. And woofing is a very nice program. It's international. And basically, you can go and work willingly on organic farms. And that's what woof is, working willingly on organic farms. And basically, you just work for them, and then you can stay with them, and they feed you. So it's a really great way to travel inexpensively and to meet people in the countries that you're traveling through and to see the countryside, to experience all different kinds of agriculture, and see where your particular sensibilities take you. Some of us are animal people, and some of us are plant people or flower people or, you know, tree people. And really just exposing yourself to the many different kinds of farming that there are and the many different social and physical configurations of agriculture is incredibly valuable, especially at the beginning of your agricultural career. So I did the woofing. And then I signed up for season-long apprenticeship at a biodynamic farm in California and worked there with a CSA and flower production and apples and goats. And then I went back to school and got a degree at UC Berkeley in agroecology, which is basically the ecology of agriculture. Then I got out of school and I started my own farm. And every summer I would go off and work on, when I was in school, every summer I would go off and work on dairies in Switzerland, because I'm definitely a cow type of person. And the Swiss are really good with dairy. I don't know if you've noticed, but the Swiss cheeses are the best cheeses. So I went and made cheese, different kinds of cheese, in the valleys and high up in the elevations, working with different scales of farms, some who brought their milk to a cheese maker, some who made the cheese in their own little hut. And then we started our own farm, and it went okay, but we lost our land. And this coming season, I'm going to go work for another young farmer who's a great friend of mine and a fabulous entrepreneur in Connecticut. So pretty much I'm still at the very beginning of my agricultural career and have been spending a lot of the time organizing as well as farming. But I think that organizing and farming go pretty well together because you have to get a lot of things organized to get a farm off the ground. So I'd say it's pretty good practice.
Yeah, and my own experience in trying to sort of part-time farm in northern Canada, we had to have community. You just couldn't do it on your own, especially when harvest time comes. You need a lot of people in hands, or if you want to put up a barn, or you know, you need people's help all the time. Well, look, there's a lot of new tools available that weren't available to me for communicating smaller-scale farming techniques. Maybe we could start with your new film. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. There's so many tools available, and I, you know, certainly it's hard to start from scratch, and certainly it's hard to go it alone, and I think there's no need to, especially now when we have such a rich digital realm, and there's so many people out and about communicating and providing resources for people interested to engage in this work. So if you are such a person interested to engage in this work, I would say one place you might want to start looking is on our website. And to see we have a short film up there, which is just the kind of a teaser for our final film, which is going to hopefully be done by the end of the summer. We also have a weekly radio show, which is every week another young farmer interview from all around the country talking about what they do and why they do it and the practicalities of their day-to-day living and their vision for how their work will enhance the sustainability of their food system. And so that's available on a podcast, so you can even upload it into your iPod or whatever. And then we have a guidebook, which is freely downloadable. And then it is, in fact, bigger than just a guidebook. It's actually a wiki. So if you know of resources that aren't in there, you can even upload new things into it. So in that way, it's participatory. But that guidebook basically covers a lot of introductory ground, helping you think through your professional trajectory, helping you to get a sense of the institutional matrix that exists to serve you as a young person in agriculture. You know, the fact that there are conferences and apprenticeships that you ought to consider learning a little bit casually first, but then committing to a farm and really engaging in a longer-term educational experience, kind of coaching you through that process as you start to consider your own career in farming and learning all that you need to know to plan that career.
And what is that web address?
Oh, yeah, the web address is www.thegreenhorns.net. And you can also link from there. We have a whole bunch of buttons on the homepage that you can just navigate all these different programs. It's a lot more linear than when I describe it. But we have a blog also there, and which is basically like a rolling newsletter, and every day there's videos and announcements about events relevant to young farmers and news relevant to young farmers, parties, conferences, job opportunities, land opportunities, apprenticeships, paid farm manager positions, you know, pretty much just information that's relevant to young farmers. And that blog is now getting almost 1,000 hits a day on average, which means that if you have something to share with other folks and you want to spread the news with the community, you're welcome to email us and tell us what you want to announce so we can put it on the blog. So in every way, we're trying to communicate and create space for communication within and among the young farmer community using digital tools, mostly because that's what we can afford to use as a very small nonprofit, mostly based out of our homes and from a pretty far-flung network of volunteers. We can use these digital tools to create infrastructure for ourselves in a way that we probably couldn't have 10 years ago. And in a way that is pretty amazing, because we can reach really, really far, and most of the software that we're using is free. So pretty much if somebody else wanted to do what we're doing in another field, or if they wanted to do more of what we're doing in our field, they could do it too.
Wow, those are a lot of resources. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking young farmers with Severin von Scharner Fleming from thegreenhorns.net. Severin, I'm a little concerned people will stop at the barrier of actually doing something. They may feel satisfied they've learned something on the computer. Maybe they'll apply it later if they have to. In my experience, it just does take years of practice. So you've given us some tips already, but is there some way to, I mean, is it worthwhile to just start growing something at home, or even see if you can get some backyard chickens going, or just start?
Yeah, people are always saying that chickens are like the gateway drug into self-sufficiency. Because once you start having those eggs on your table, and you taste the difference, and you start to have a relationship with that funny little clucky lady on your lawn, things start to change pretty fast inside your head, and it can end up causing some more significant changes in your life. I think it is a challenge to pop into action and move from theory into practice, but from what I've seen, people are doing it all the time, and what they need is help moving from that first gesture and that first impulse and that first action to a sustained series of actions that will continue to support them personally and socially and culturally and professionally, so that they can keep being brave and bold and doing what's right for themselves and their community. The first step is hard, and you know, showing up at the local, you know, ag meeting when there is one, or lecture when there is one, or potluck dinner is obviously the first step, and just showing up and talking about what you want to do or what you are doing or what other people are doing is incredibly important. But then I think it really behooves us all of us who care about this food system and care about our land that we live nearby and the water that flows through it in our community, if we have the capacity to support young people who are farming or to support people who are starting new businesses that are about sustainable local food, you know, that we can do things that will help those people in their lives. So, you know, if it's you who's going to make a decision to start a farm or go and sign up for an apprenticeship on a farm or work for an organic food business or take that action in your own life, it's incredibly valuable. But there's so much room for others who are busy with a lot of other things to support, and to support with their dollars, but also to support with their time and show up to the events and, you know, do the communicating and facilitating and massaging that our community needs in order for these kinds of enterprises to work. So I think depending on what time frame you have and what your ambitions are, you know, there's room for everybody.
I was really kind of inspired by your Greenhorn radio chat with Tim of Common Ground Farm. For those who don't know, could you tell us about community-supported agriculture, what that is?
Oh, yes. Tim is so wonderful. Community-supported agriculture, which is also known as CSA. The CSA has been around not that long, but it's been tremendously successful as a model. In the model, the community, a.k.a. the eaters, a.k.a. the consumers, spend the money up front. They invest in the farmer in the spring, and then the farmer, their whole summer, gives them every week a box of vegetables from the farm. So essentially, the consumers are prepaying the farmer for the food, but as a consequence of that prepayment, the farmer has money in the spring to buy seeds, to buy inputs, to repair machinery and capitalize their farm slightly in anticipation of the season. And then they have a reliable marketplace for their product. So it just takes the drama and the hustle out of growing, and it allows especially young people who wouldn't necessarily have the financial stability in their lives to front such a large amount of thousands of dollars in the beginning of the season, wait around hoping that someone's going to buy the produce later on. It really can allow people who wouldn't be able to farm and just start off small and a manageable size and grow at an organic pace rather than at the pace dictated by the bank. So in that way, the community is kind of like the farmer's bank.
And that might be another way into access for the land for the many of us who don't inherit a working farm. We've got to have some way of getting to the land to do this adventure.
Yes, and many CSAs are wonderful in that they require a certain amount of service from their community members. And one wonderful thing about the CSAs is, and their popularity is that there's waiting lists practically at every CSA, people just really wanting to be a part of this community and wanting to get access to really the freshest food that they can get. This is food that's picked, you know, usually on the day or the day before, at the prime of its ripeness, and just picked especially for you and waiting without being jostled too much in your little box. And so because there's such a waiting list and such a demand, it establishes a very positive, in my mind, reciprocity between the eater and the farmer. And so because the farmer wants to grow, but the eater also really wants to eat, so in a sense they're reaching their hands out across the table as equal partners in that exchange. So lots of farmers in that new kind of social relationship are inviting those eaters onto their farm to harvest. Many CSAs have you-pick sections where the CSA members are going to pick their own strawberries or raspberries or blackberries, just because that's one of the things that is most labor-intensive in the height of July. And then with that comes access to the farmer and access to the farm. And in many instances, people are volunteering one day every other week or one day a month, and a lot of CSAs are finding that members of their community are delivering boxes to other checkpoints or getting involved in helping with accounting or getting involved in learning about the animals on the farm. And so there's just a whole another level of engagement that's possible once you become a member of a community like that.
So it's a hotbed for human development as well as the plants and animals that might be there. You also talked with Eric Hoffner about the Drake Forum on Beginning Farmers held in Washington, D.C. in early March 2010. What was happening there?
Well, that was really exciting. I mean, so in Washington, D.C., this was almost a month ago now, there was a two-day-long forum hosted by Drake University, which is a ag law center in Iowa. And they were interested to convene a kind of a national conversation about the beginning farmer issue. Now, you mentioned in your introduction, and those familiar with the young farmer and beginning farmer issues will know that the average American farmer is 57 years old. And according to the Iowa Farm Poll, 42% of those farmers are interested to retire in the next 5 years. So we're essentially facing a pretty dire crisis of attrition, where farmers are just, there's less and less of them, and they're older and older, and they deserve to retire. You're not supposed to have to work until you croak. So the Drake Forum was organized essentially to inform the USDA staffers and policymakers in Washington, D.C. about this very important issue, and to bring into one place all the voices who have relevant insight and experience and a programmatic history and educational history and training history with beginning farmers. So that whole forum is actually available in podcast form, and it's linked from our blog. So if you go to our blog, you can listen also on your iPod to the various sessions, and it was just dense with information about farm workers and new immigrant farmers and urban farming, the difficulties that folks are facing getting loans for farm startups, some wonderful farmers talking about their success and their business really thriving, and then some farmers talking about the challenges that they faced getting access to land. That's a wonderful compilation of voices on this subject, and really a fantastic place to have it and to convene that conversation with such a service to the movement and to our community of practitioners. You know, those of us who are engaged in this kind of thinking, you know, we don't always have the chance to be in the same room with each other and to see on each other's faces the commitment that we have. You know, it was wonderful to hear everyone, but it was really wonderful to see everyone there and just to realize what a strong team of forceful and optimistic people we all are.
Well, against the stereotype that you kind of alluded to, people think that farmers may be old people who are in boots and maybe dressed badly, and now you and your friends come along and make this all cool. Is that working?
Well, according to the census data, the last census, there were only 3% of farmers under the age of 35. And this most recent census that just came in, it said 6% of farmers under the age of 35. So still, we are a super minority. You know, of course, less than 2% of the American population are farming. So, you know, we're a minority of a minority of a minority. However, we're a growing minority, and we're a fierce minority, and we're every day more and more of us. So really, it's an issue of needing to scale up the level of support that we provide, the level of training that we provide, the level of cultural support for this professional decision that we do really need many, many more young people to make, so that we can continue to double and redouble and redouble our numbers and really build the businesses and the farm businesses and the food businesses that it's going to take to feed the next generation of Americans healthy food. Because really, that's what it's about, is one farm at a time and one lunchbox at a time, getting local food, local healthy food to the table for our kids.
You've given us some really good stuff here, and I want to say to listeners, if you want to get active in food or find people who are doing it, start out at www.thegreenhorns.net. You can also find links there where the film is coming out, or listen to Greenhorns Radio and just learn how to get going. I'd like to thank Eric Hoffner for the tip about this, and Severn Von Scharner Fleming for sharing her enthusiasm with us today. Thank you, Severn.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. I look forward to listening to the rest of your program.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their pick.
You should go to the woods. Go to the classroom of the trees and learn the things we all need to know. The city mouse might need to spend a little time in the forest if things get rough back in the streets. Or maybe you'll pass through there when the freeway is plugged. Of course, you might just want to find your roots with a family campout. With a little effort, you can find extra food in the woods, walking, flying, popping out of the ground and growing all around. So I'd say, plan to get out in your local wild spaces. If you can explore what's right around you without getting shot, arrested, or fenced in, that is the best. Know what's close to home. If not, find something similar in a park or outside of town. Don't go alone at first, and don't go unprepared, and don't go in hunting season. And that brings up something important for the greenhorn woodsman or woodswoman. Other folks will be there, for all kinds of reasons. Hunting season is easy. Find out when it is and don't go then. Seriously, when I lived in the bush, nobody sensible went out in hunting season unless you were a hunter. And keep your dogs in, or leash, too. I've lost 2 good dogs to hunters coming illegally onto my property, shooting anything that moved, leaving beer cans, 40-pounders, shells, bones, and a bunch of sadness behind. Never mind the no trespassing signs. The other denizens of the forest can be cranky, too. In this part of the world, it's the mushroom hunters. Not for the frying pan, mind you, but for frying brains with magic mushrooms. That's a multi-million dollar business. Some mushroom hunters are very protective of their patch. They may be armed. Don't ask too many questions.
See them gaily gad about. They love to play and shout. They never have any cares. At 6 o'clock, their mummies and daddies will take them home to bed, 'cause they're tired little teddy bears.
I suppose as times get tougher, there may be a few outlaws camped out there too, but most of those can be friendly enough. Bears don't want your business at all. Wear a bell, a whistle, a tune, and grizzly country. I won't bore you with all my bear stories. The whole point is, find out what is going on in the woods near you. Figure out where the trails are, starting with the human ones and working toward the deer trails. Where is the water? Is it safe enough to drink? Another tip, so obvious greenhorns can't do it, as you enter and move around a wooded area, start working on a little mental map. Notice where the sun is tracking across the sky, or find the pole star at night. Look for an odd-shaped hill or mountain to serve as a guide, or a very tall tree. If you have a compass, use it. In the deep woods, if moving along deer trails that can divide or disappear, try marking your way with stones or bent branches. notice things, and keep looking backward to study what things look like if you return the same way. It's so strange how different things become when you look back. Now that you have the tools to avoid getting lost, spend some time observing. What is there to eat, if you need it? At first it seems nothing, but exploration can tell you otherwise. The bulbs at the base of bulrushes can be boiled up. Poplar bark has a layer that can be made into primitive flour. At the right time of year, that clearing is loaded with berries. Never eat a white berry. There isn't a white berry that is good for you, and there are some that make you very, very sick. Further south, there may be wild nut trees out there, too. And again, there are edible mushrooms. That is why you got a field guide or at least Googled mushrooms to learn which are tasty and which will kill you. Like the red-topped Amanita muscaria, don't eat that. But if you lose your job or just want to enrich your diet, it's hard to beat fresh-picked mushrooms from the woods. First, you have to find out where they are and when. While you're in the woods, learn tree names by their bark. That way you'll know which are best for firewood or maple sugar in the winter when the leaves are gone. Trees provided almost all shelter, machinery, furniture, and even clothing for most of my human times and yours. We easily get disconnected watching screens and interacting on the net. May I suggest you exercise your right to survive by learning how to get around and get by in the woods. This has been a message from Uncle Al.
For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
Hello.
This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Let me bring you songs from the woods to make you feel much better than you could know.
Better than you could
dust
know.
Dust you down from tip to toe.
Dust you down from tip to toe.
Show you how the garden grows.
Show you how the garden
Hold
grows.
Hold you steady as you go.
Hold steady as you
join the chorus if you can. It'll make of you an honest man.
Let me bring you love from the fields, poppies red and roses filled with summer rain, to heal the wound and still the pain that threatens again and again, as we drag down every lover's lane.
Life's long celebrations here. I'll toast you all in here.
A lot of us are beginning to question our food. Is it safe? Where is it coming from? Many people want to take an active role while preparing for harder times to come as energy spikes and the climate shifts. We look to new voices, and Sharon Astick is someone you'll find both doing and communicating in many forums. She's a New England mother and small-scale grower now teaching food survival skills. Sharon, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with something from your latest book with co-author Aaron Newton called A Nation of Farmers. You picked out the year 2008 as a kind of tipping point for food. Tell us about that.
Well, I think in 2008 was sort of the critical moment when we saw people begin to be really conscious of their food in a way that they hadn't been before. And we saw a number of things happen. First of all, that was the year of the food crisis internationally, and all of us saw on the news what ended up being, more than a billion people are now hungry, the most that have ever been in human history. And it also was a moment where people were transitioning into an awareness of where their food was coming from. And both in bad ways, that's when we had the melamine scandal, and we had a botulism scandal with processed food, and in really good ways, as more than 2 million people started gardening that year. So it really is a critical moment in our history that we started thinking about our food in ways we hadn't been.
And you've been involved with the peak oil movement for some years now. What kinds of social changes do you see from that coming energy crunch?
One of the things that's changing is I think that more and more people realize that they can't expect to know what it's going to cost them to do things like feed their families or heat their home. And we've certainly seen the ways that energy and food are sort of deeply intertwined. The rise in food prices, the UN estimates that about 60% of that had to do with biofuel usage, which was being ramped up to compensate for high oil prices. And in fact, we're sort of seeing that situation play out again now. And we can expect to see food prices starting to rise as oil prices rise. So one of the things that was really sort of startling, I think, was for people to realize just how tightly linked food and energy prices are and how volatile those prices are and how unstable they are.
And it started, I think, this peak oil movement as kind of an insider guy thing with a lot of technical expertise. And now you say it's a women's issue. Why is that?
Well, quite some time ago, back in 2005, I wrote a piece called Peak Oil is a Women's Issue. And that was precisely because at the time I was one of the few women writing about energy and environmental issues in the same way. And I think the alarm was raised by people who were technical experts, people who were doing petroleum geology, people who were doing alternative energy technologies. And I don't want to minimize the enormous importance of what they did. But once you get past the variations on, you know, well, peak oil is 2008, peak oil will be 2012, you know, debates, you get down to the fact that peak oil and climate change both represent to us a larger and more basic question that can't be answered by people whose focus is the technologies and the technical details, which is how are we going to live? And that, I think, particularly when we're dealing with things like food and shelter and basic, you know, basic support systems, that is a women's issue. And that's an issue, I think, that resonates really deeply with women.
So I was thinking about talking with you. I also thought about our meat production system. You know, we treat sensitive animals like they're pieces of stone or wood. For example, agri-corporations, they say it's okay to stack pigs in metal cages 3 or 4 feet high with no exercise and fed until they're abnormally fat. And I thought, you know, now that I think about it, isn't that the way we're starting to live ourselves?
I think there's some of that. I think that, you know, in some ways we're abnormally aware of animals. I mean, I think that human history has not always been one of great sensitivity to animals. Certainly we don't bull bait or, you know, anymore. On the other hand, I also think that we have become sort of hypersensitive about our personal pets while permitting categories of animals and humans to be industrialized in ways that are just inhumane. So we, for example, really get upset when a natural disaster happens and somebody's dogs or cats are left behind, and yet we will raise chickens and pigs and cows in factory conditions. We have the same problems with human beings. There are categories of humans that we're really capable of identifying with in very sort of sensitive and strong ways, and whole categories of human in the world who we really don't identify with, and we're perfectly content to have them ground up in an industrial machine.
I think you've got a good point there, and we're going to all have to search for solutions on that. But moving to another front, you've also suggested that more sustainable farming could help the climate. And I know that's a huge issue. We could write a book just about that. But could you give us a couple of hints on how that might work?
Sure. Somewhere between 20 and 35%, depending on who you ask and how you draw the circle, of all climate gases are related to agriculture. And what we have found is that we really need to deal with these. We need to deal with food systems. And it's not just carbon, it's methane. And one of the major sources of methane, of course, is our feedlot agriculture with animals. And it's also nitrous oxide, which is produced when we use artificial fertilizers on our grains. So we have this enormous difficulty of dealing with this climate project, and it's being horribly expanded by the way we're growing food. However, those natural systems that we rely on to grow our food are also systems that are capable of holding carbon. Our soils contain carbon, our oceans contain carbon, our forests are great carbon sinks. And there's some really interesting information about ways that we could do this. For example, Joel Salatin, who's a somewhat famous farmer, he's wrote the book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. Well, his pastures, which have been managed without tillage for many, many years, are sequestering as much carbon as a similarly sized forest. And he's raising food off of them. He's raising meat on grass. And the manure that's enriching those soils is allowing him to sequester large quantities of carbon. So one of the things that Aaron and I talk about in the Nation of Farmers is the way that home-scale agriculture can allow us to be part of the solution, because of course we have, you know, 30 million acres of lawn in the United States, most of which is contributing to the carbon problem rather than helping.
And that climate crisis is developing so fast. You know, I'm thinking of the floods in Rhode Island and Katrina, and I can see the day coming when bankrupt state and federal governments, and most of them seem to be going bankrupt, they won't be able to provide the disaster aid or even maybe repair the damaged infrastructure. So how could decentralized food or knowing how to grow our own help people get through possibly difficult times?
Well, I think if we look at the history of societies that have suffered sort of a collapse to a lower level of function. That doesn't necessarily mean they've turned into Mad Max, but they've gone from being a more affluent society to a less affluent society, or they've gone from being a more engaged government to one where government's overwhelmed by its own problems. We find that people really do turn to their gardens. In the United States during the Great Depression, in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In Russia, it was really fascinating. Economists who analyzed the problem looked at the Russian people and said, by all measures, these people should be starving. And they weren't. And nobody could figure out where they were being fed. And they were being fed largely from gardens. They were being fed from small-scale farms and small gardens. And in fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia has been bucking the world trend, and its farms are actually getting smaller because people don't trust large farms anymore. They don't trust industrial agriculture. They know that can fall apart. So what they trust are small and local farms. So we have some pretty good evidence that if you look through our history, when sort of distant systems become hard to control, when there's a lot of disruption in our society, that local agriculture can step in and fill the gap. It's not a perfect solution to every problem. There can still be problems at the local level where you can lose local harvest, and that's why you certainly want relationships between cities and countryside. You certainly want trade to continue. But if you're not dependent for every bite of your food to come from long distances, if you need to trade for fewer items, if you're importing a smaller percentage of your food, you have a level of resilience that we don't have right now.
Well, you raise a good point, too. I mean, surely we don't have the room for everyone to leave the city for the country to achieve an agrarian renaissance. So what is the role for city dwellers now?
Well, and I think that's really important. I think, in fact, one of the things that I say very often is that we most need to grow food exactly where people are. We don't need to necessarily move more food production outside of the cities. We need to move more of it in. And what we find, again, if you look at other countries, what we find is that in a lot of the developing world, cities produce somewhere around 25% of two things. Their fresh vegetables and their meats. They produce their meats by making use of all of the food scraps that dense populations have, from restaurants and from households to feed things like pigs and chickens. Instead of buying grain, and which is what we do now, we feed our meat animals on grains, they're actually feeding their animals on food scraps and keeping those food scraps out of landfills and also making sure that there's more calories locally. And the other thing that's being grown in gardens are vegetables. And studies overwhelmingly find that urban and peri-urban agriculture makes a huge difference in nutrition, particularly child nutrition. Children of families that are engaged in urban agriculture, even very, very poor families, tend to have nutritional levels that are equivalent to middle-class families.
I'd like to run something by you about going back to the land. You know, I was part of the Back to Land movement in the late 1970s, and nuclear war seemed possible. New York City and Chrysler both did go bankrupt. I think it was around 1981. People lost their homes to 20% interest rates. It all sounds kind of familiar now, but things did recover. So I guess my point is, I feel that people should move to a rural setting not because they fear the apocalypse, but because they want a real and healthy lifestyle, and maybe they're seeking a more functional community. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that rural life is not for everybody. It has advantages and disadvantages. I've chosen it personally, but not because I don't like cities or think there's a future for them, but because I do like the country and I do like my way of life. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of rhetoric in the peak oil and climate change movement about one kind of model. Oh, well, we all have to live in dense, walkable, new urbanist cities, or, you know, that's it. It's the end of suburbia. That's the end of this, you know. I think that, quite honestly, things are going to be more complicated than that. We're going to have some suburbs that survive and are quite functional, and some suburbs that we let go. We're going to see some cities that can't stay at the sizes that they are now, that are going to decline, and some cities that will probably succeed extremely well. There have been cities of a million people for 2,000 years. We're certainly going to see some countryside areas, I think, become more important as they supply food systems, but some may find themselves isolated without transportation or sufficient water. So I think it's going to be a very complicated movement of, you know, of both people and landscape that we're going to see over the next century, and it's very hard to predict exactly how that's going to play out. So I think people should live where they want to.
Good point. Do you see a change coming in land ownership? I mean, right now it costs a lot of money to buy a property that you can farm, even near a small market, and many younger people are loaded with student loans or credit card debt or may even be coming out of a period of unemployment. How can people get access or get growing, get some experience in this?
I think that's a really important thing, and I think land access may become one of the central issues of our times in the United States, just as it has been in much of the developing world. I think there are a lot of ways that people can get access to land if they don't have it. I mean, there are some obvious ones, like you can look for community garden plots. If there isn't one in your neighborhood or your community, you should definitely consider starting them. And many urban centers are really into community gardens now because they're a low-cost development project they can do without straining the already strained city budgets. But there are other ways. My co-author, Aaron Newton, started his first CSA farming on a mix of public land and in his neighbor's yards. He contacted older neighbors who were having trouble taking care of their yards. He grows food in their yards and gives them a share for the space and spreads the rest around to his neighbors. Certainly, there are lots of farmers out there who are looking for younger people to apprentice to them because their own children don't want to go into the business, and the average American farmer is 59 years old. So we're going to have to deal with this question of who's going to grow our food, regardless of peak oil and climate change. We have a demographic crisis in agriculture.
Our guest is Sharon Astick, who I'll call one of the new green pioneers. She might not take that label, but I like it. And in 2008, she published the book Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront from New Society Publishers. And now her latest, A Nation of Farmers. Sharon, can you describe some of the new agrarian experiments that hold some promise?
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. I think my parents were part of the Back to the Land movement in the 1970s, and I think one of the things that sort of was really successful about that movement is that it gave people a sense of, you know, what was possible to create a new food system. I mean, that's a really big thing. We didn't have an organic agriculture movement. We didn't have this kind of localized food system. And that's really a legacy, I think, of the old Back to the Land movement. What I think is maybe more successful about the modern version is that people aren't necessarily trying to reinvent everything at once. My own sense is that the previous movement was also trying to reinvent social arrangements. So the sort of communal households that were typical in a lot of back to land movements often didn't succeed. And one of the things that I'm seeing is a lot of people going back to the land, but with their families, with extended families, with their parents, going back to or buying land together with friends, but people living in separate households rather than in sort of traditional communal models. And I think that's really fascinating. I also really think city farming is one of the most fascinating things, and there's some really amazing experiments going on with what people are growing and raising in urban centers right now. There's an amazing number of agricultural projects out there, including there's a lot of woody agriculture stuff going on. Phil Rutter up at Badgerset Farm is doing some amazing things with chestnuts and with hazels as calorie crops to replace soybeans, which, I mean, these things are really amazing, and there's so many possibilities. We've changed our food system so much in some ways in the last 60 years. It gives us a sense of what's possible when we think about the kinds of changes we have to make in the future.
As you've said, many of the farmers with the most knowledge are growing old. What have you seen out there in the way of skills transfer, of passing on the necessary know-how?
That's a difficult one, and it's difficult for a couple of reasons. We're actually facing, I think, a really strange situation. It's one we've never had in human history, that after this generation of farmers, the majority of American farmers won't have been raised on a farm. It's a very strange thing because that has literally never happened before. The children of farmers were the primary backbone of our agricultural community for all of human history. You learned this stuff at your parents' knees. And what we've seen for decades and decades is the gradual decline in farmers down to the well under 2% that we're seeing now. Well, those numbers are going to have to rise as we shift from less oil in agriculture. And the average farmer is 59 years old, as I said before, so we're going to have to start new farmers. And those people are going to come not out of farm families, because most of those older farmers' children have already left the land. They're going to come from probably two places, and I've been writing about this recently. The first is they're going to come out of gardens. They're going to come out of suburban backyards and schoolyard gardens and inner city gardens, because that's where those young people will have come into contact with food production and agriculture. They're not being raised on farms. They're getting this experience elsewhere. The other place that they're coming from is they're coming from immigrant populations, many of whom are, you know, fairly recently removed from large populations of farmers, and people grew up on farms. And I think that's where the new face of American farming is really shifting, and it's going to be a complicated transition, I think.
And you teach food preservation using online classes. How does that work?
Well, I think a lot of us actually really want to take the next step in dealing with our food system. You know, you grow vegetables, and then you think, okay, I've got more of this than I need. What am I going to do next? And that's this question. And everybody sort of remembers their grandma putting up those canned goods, but most of us didn't pay attention, and we don't remember how to do these things. So when I first started growing food, the next step for me was learning how to preserve it. And having done that, I started teaching other people and writing about it. And in fact, my latest book actually from last year is Independence Days, which is a guide to sustainable food storage and preservation. And what's been really interesting to me was, you know, I wrote two books. One of them was about peak oil and climate change and the sort of state of our problem. And people used to argue with me a lot when I would do interviews about that one. And one of them was The Nation of Farmers. And, you know, parts of it people really liked. They liked the gardening part. But then when I said, well, we really need a lot more people to be involved in the food system, they'd argue. But whenever I start talking about making jam and putting things in root cellars and preserving, what everybody says is, oh, my grandma did that. I really want to know how to do that. So it's been a really fun project for me to see how excited people are about turning this stuff into food that they can have all year round, that they can save money with, that they can enjoy, and sort of take that next step in eating locally.
I'd like to hear about your own experience in food production. What have you been up to?
Crazy. I think that's the best thing to start at, because I think there's no way that you would take two then urban, raised in suburbia, graduate students who really knew nothing about agriculture and say, yeah, let's get a farm and let's trust you guys to have one. And they say that God protects children and idiots. And I think that that's pretty much how we got through. But we, you know, moved with my husband's grandparents to this farm and planted our first garden ever in the dirt. Before that, I'd had gardens up on balconies and in pots. And then the next year, we said, well, we grew more than we could eat, so maybe we should have a CSA. Maybe we should deliver subscriptions to other people. And so we took 7 clients and learned a lot really fast and added chickens and started bringing them eggs and baking bread and making flowers. And at our peak, we were delivering vegetables to 22 families, all done. We don't own we never owned a tractor. We, you know, it's all done by hand labor. And then I started writing books, and I decided I could only write, I could either write books and run a CSA, but not both. So the CSA went by the wayside, and my family is now, we raise pasture poultry for meat, we raise eggs, medicinal herbs, we also raise dairy goats, and a bunch of other farm projects. And we've been working on this sort of question of what's our land best suited to? How can we use our steep, wet, rocky land in New York as best as possible and without doing damage to the wildlife habitat and while preserving as much of it as woods and as open space as possible?
When I talked with Severn von Scharner Fleming of the Greenhorns Movement, she spent the summers farming and the winters organizing. Are you finding yourself involved with the developing movement? And if so, does it have a name?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it has a bunch of names. I mean, what's sort of funny is I'm involved with a lot of movements. I have overlap with the permaculturists, with transition. I've run into the greenhorns over the years and the woofers, the willing workers on organic farms. I consider myself, if I had to pick an identity, I'd call myself an agrarian, but a modern agrarian, one who thinks that agrarian things happen in cities and suburbs as well as in the country. So what's really fascinating to me is that there's a lot of movements, and they're movements that really cross political lines, they cross social lines. I find myself speaking to groups of, I'm a leftist Jew, and I find myself speaking about these issues to groups of conservative evangelical Christians and to business groups that are concerned with food services and making sure that food prices are stable. It's really fascinating to me the degree to which this food question really unites people and gets people talking who don't talk to each other all that often. So I guess I would say that I'm part of a lot of movements.
And I've been reading your blog for over a year now. It's got some terrific stuff. I often see it reprinted all over the net in places like the Energy Bulletin and the Oil Drum and Grist or Hen and Harvest. But you seem to have sort of switched blogs. And so can you give us your latest blog address where listeners can find you?
Yeah, I blog in two places. My farm blog is www.sharonastick.com, and Astick is A-S-T-Y-K. And I also recently switched over to Science Blogs, which is the largest technology and science blogging site on the net, actually. And I did that because it brought in a new audience for me, and it particularly has brought in a new audience of people who come at this from a technical viewpoint and who haven't necessarily thought a lot about the social questions raised by this. So I also blog at www.scienceblogs.com/Casaubon's book, and Casaubon is C-A-S-A-U-B-O-N, and it's all one word, Casaubon's book.
And where does that word come from?
It's actually from a George Eliot novel. Casaubon is in Middlemarch, is the old man who thinks he can write a theory of everything, and it's sort of my reminder to myself not to get too arrogant.
Well, as we wrap up, Sharon, is there something else that you would like to leave with our listeners?
The biggest thing that I'd like to suggest to people is that for a long time we've regarded food as something that our primary relationship was as consumers, both literally as people who eat and also consumers as people who buy. And one of the things that I think is going to be really important about the next century is that that's not enough of a relationship with our food. We're going to have to get involved. And the reason I wrote A Nation of Farmers, the reason Aaron and I worked on that together, was because I think it's so important that people get involved at every level, that they get involved in thinking about where their food comes from when they buy it, that they get involved in thinking about the people who do the work, often hard, dangerous, dirty work of growing their food, that they get involved in thinking about the systems that support the kind of food system we want and the kind of food system we have at present, and also that they get to the basic system and start thinking about, well, how can I produce even a little food in my own garden? And remember that those little bits, those little gardens all over the place add up to a rather great deal. I mean, the thing that I always point out to everybody is in 1944, at the height of the Victory Garden movement, Victory Gardens in the United States grew as much produce as all of the produce farms combined in the United States. So all those little, that window box full of lettuces, that, 100-square-foot garden, those things really add up and they really matter.
You've inspired me. I think we can do this. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Sharon Astick. She's a subsistence farmer, writer, and activist in New England. Find her at SharonAstick.com. Sharon, thank you for doing all that you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it. I'm Alex, and I'm out of here. Like the women drafted back to the land in Great Britain during the war. Dig in, folks. We have a lot of people to feed and room to grow from deep down inside.
Get your own good food.
Oh, the Indian corn had a red, red song. Chinese cabbage tried to kick the gong. You should have seen that fresh green bean when the chili pepper punched out the mustard green. Old man zucchini was such a meanie. He picked a fight with the kosher weenie. He said,
No meat allowed. This is a vegetable crowd.
Down at the barnyard.